I want to talk about King Ahaz. Now, Ahaz, you know, the takeaway lesson from this guy is that he does not abrogate Yahweh. He doesn't actually say, I don't believe in Yahweh anymore. But what he does, he mixes flesh and spirit. He mixes Yahweh worship with idolatry. And this, of course, is the continual problem with Israel, and it is actually our continual problem, that we will not probably turn around and become hardcore atheists and throw ourselves into the life of sin and wickedness. No. But we mix flesh and spirit. This is our weakness. And this is why looking at somebody like Ahaz is really helpful, because you see really in all these people who do this worked warnings for each of us. Well, the summary about Ahaz in 2 Kings 16 is that he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Now, that's often said, and it's as if Israel are described as the source of Judah's apostasy, but we've got to give due weight to Ezekiel's word that Judah was in fact more wicked in the end than Israel. How you understand that, I'm not sure, but I suppose you could say they were more wicked in that they fell further, or they wasted more spiritual potential than Israel did. Or perhaps it's a case of sinners provoking other people to sin even worse than they do. But I do think it's true of Ahaz that perhaps he was worse than Israel in that he fell further. He didn't have to be like this. We read that he made his son to pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the nations. Well, Hezekiah was Ahaz's son. And it would seem that his brothers had been killed by his father. And, of course, Hezekiah was the son who survived, or possibly the son who was passed through the fire and survived, was therefore going to be very against idolatry, because it was just a basic psychological reaction against what he'd seen in perhaps quite early boyhood, seen as his brothers being burnt by his father, or he himself going through the trauma of being put through fire. And so he's against idolatry. And yet we're going to see in the next few chapters, all through really Hezekiah's life, that he actually doesn't live as he should have done. And he actually repeats, in essence, the failures of Ahaz. You may be radically against some forms of idolatry, but that doesn't mean that you are therefore living a spiritual life. So, King of Syria and the king of Israel came up against Jerusalem to war, and they besieged Ahaz but couldn't overcome him. Well, 2 Chronicles 28 says that they had huge victories against Ahaz, but they couldn't take Jerusalem. He sort of outlived the siege, but he pretty well lost all of Judah apart from Jerusalem. And that's just the picture you get in Isaiah of the Assyrian invasion in Hezekiah's time, that it was as if they were floodwaters that had overcome all of Judah and had gone up to the neck. That is, Jerusalem was like the only bit that was still above water. And so you see that in Hezekiah's life, a lot of things repeated that had gone on in the life of his father and that he had seen as a young person. And yet he doesn't seem to learn the lessons from Ahaz, and this is the trouble, that God works according to patterns, and those patterns are clearly displayed throughout the Bible, which is, in one sense, a lot of biography, to show us the hallmark of God's hand, to see how similar processes go on in different people's lives. Well, Ahaz tried to get out of the problem by saying to the king of Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser, I'm your servant and your son, come up and save me. And that is exactly what Hezekiah does. They both give the gold of the temple and the precious things of the temple to Gentile kings to come and save them. So Hezekiah really doesn't learn from the mistakes of his father, even though he reacts very strongly against his father's idolatry. And this is all very bitingly relevant to us. It's quite natural to react against your upbringing. That is, I think, part and parcel of individuating as a human. And yet, that is not the same as true spirituality. Well, Hezekiah apparently reformed everything, but I say apparently because it's like a lot of these reforms that went on by the kings. It's described in very glowing terms, but then you read that actually an awful lot of bad stuff still remained, a bit like perhaps our self-examination. For example, in Isaiah, in 2 Kings 31, you read that it wasn't until the time of Josiah that Josiah removes the idols that were on the roof of Ahaz's house. Well, Hezekiah didn't remove them. It wasn't until Josiah that they got removed. So, you know, his reaction against idolatry, although it's written up in very glowing terms, in reality it was not perhaps as strong as it might have been. Well, the king of Assyria did respond to Ahaz, but we read in 2 Chronicles 28, he did come to him and distressed him, but didn't strengthen him. Giving God's money, as it were, God's wealth to Gentile secular strength never achieved anything. It only made matters worse, and that's a continual theme of the kings. But again, Hezekiah failed to learn. It didn't help him. Was the comment on Ahaz's experience of trying to do this, and Hezekiah goes and does exactly the same. It's this inability to learn from history, which, as has been often pointed out, even in secular wisdom, is, I'm afraid, an abiding characteristic of human beings. And yet the Bible is history. Even if you consider secular history generally to be bunk or to be just of passing cultural interest, well, biblical history is different. It's recorded because all this that's recorded is reflecting a pattern of human response to the divine hand. And we're to learn from this, because who hasn't been tempted to use what is really God's wealth and whatever God's resources that he's given to us to try to resolve an issue in a faithless way? And yet, Ahaz did not become an atheist. In Isaiah 7, you've got that incident where he's challenged to ask God for a sign, and he says with a sort of fake, sort of Uriah Heep kind of fawning humility, no, I won't ask for a sign, neither will I tempt Yahweh. And God is cross with him. And so he has this desire to show that he still believes in Yahweh and even that he respects him. But then Ahaz sends to Urijah the priest the fashion of an altar that he wants replicated. He worships the gods of Syria as well as the gods of Assyria. 2 Chronicles 28 says he sacrificed to the gods of Damascus, which struck him. He said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, I'll sacrifice to them as well. Maybe they will help me. But they were the ruin of him. And yet he also sacrifices to the gods of Assyria. So, it's so sad that the temple, when it finally fell, was full of idols of all sorts of different gods. Most nations were loyal to their gods. And as the prophets point out, what a strange, sad person or woman or nation Israel were, that they were not faithful to their God. They weren't faithful to any God. They just had loads of them. In Hosea and also in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, Israel are likened to a woman who's got a sexual addiction problem. The more she sleeps around with men, the more she wants different men. And this looked forward to how Judah kept on going to different idols. This is the thing, unless you really accept that Yahweh, our God, is one, then this will be your miserable experience. And to believe that God is one is far more than saying, yep, I'm a Unitarian, I'm not a Trinitarian. Far more than that. It is to have him as your only hope. And not to have him as just one aspect of your religious thinking or one aspect of your psychology, as it were, and yet trusting in all these other gods and idols, which, of course, we can so easily have in this age. So Urijah the priest, we're told, built this altar. And he made it before King Ahaz returned from Damascus. Now, Urijah the priest is presumably the Urijah of Isaiah 8, who was one of Isaiah's inner circles. So even Isaiah's inner circle had fallen away. It's a really pretty tragic situation. The king then offers on it. Ahaz acted as a priest. He offers on it, he offers sacrifices, he pours out the drink offering, he sprinkles the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. But he's not struck down. When Uzziah tried to do that, he was struck down. He was told, it does not appertain to you, Uzziah, to be doing this. You are not a Levite. And also, you notice that Ahaz lives a really long life. And you think, well, why wasn't he struck down? And you wonder, and you think that, well, okay, we don't know the ultimate answer, but perhaps God really wanted him to repent. Maybe God was really giving him chances again and again and again that he turned down, which means that his long life was really a sort of a tacit reflection of his absolute stubbornness to the end. Well, when you read about Ahaz sprinkling the blood of his peace offerings on this idolatrous altar that he's put in the temple, well, you think of the breaking of bread as our peace offering, which is a celebration of our peace with God. And, you know, is it genuine or is it fake? Are we just going through the motion? Are we pretending we have peace with God? Are we refusing to address real issues in our lives? Then the bronze altar, which was before Yahweh, Ahaz brought from the front of the house and put it on the north side of his altar. You notice he didn't actually destroy it. He saw himself as reinterpreting, I suppose, Yahweh worship, mixing it in with all his other stuff. And then you read that he cuts off, he mutilates, really, the laver. He obviously didn't see the need for personal cleansing in this new approach that he had. And the existence of the laver before one came to the holy place was clearly to teach Israel that they were to value the need for cleansing before they approached to God. But he didn't see that. He didn't destroy it completely. He cuts off the panels of the bases and takes the laver off the bronze oxen that were underneath it, put it on a pavement of stone. So all the time you're seeing him mixing idolatry with Yahweh worship. And it was the same, really, when you come to a church like Corinth. When you read 1 Corinthians 11 about the breaking of bread and Paul is rebuking them for getting drunk, well, yeah, what they were doing, they were turning the breaking of bread into some sort of similar cult idol worship that had that was going on in the pagan shrines that were all around them. And that's the problem, that people mix flesh and spirit. And you end up, as I say, with a situation like was happening in Corinth, where people met together ostensibly to break bread and to keep the memorial meeting, when in fact they had turned this into a kind of idol worship session, just as there were that there was wine present there and people got drunk on it. Well, they mixed that in with their Christian worship. And you can draw a pretty horrible picture, really, when you look at what you can deduce about what's going on in Ephesus, both from Ephesians and from Paul's letters to Timothy, particularly 1 Timothy, and also reading between the lines of the letter to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians. It would even seem that there was cult prostitution going on at the breaking of bread service, at the Last Supper, at the Lord's Supper. They had mixed their pagan ways of worship with Christian ways of worship, and we may recoil in horror at the idea of using prostitutes at the memorial service, the idea of getting drunk on the wine at the breaking of bread meeting. And sure, I guess we don't do that, or anything near it, but in essence we can do the same. And although we are saved by grace, absolutely, we need to be careful that we don't practice reductionism and minimalization to the point where actually our Christianity is no more than mere religion and is actually just a service of the flesh. This is the trouble of any approach that is anything less than an agreement to give God all my heart, soul, and mind. Now, if we fail to do that, so we do. But that is what we should wish to give him. Absolutely. Absolute total surrender, total loyalty. Of course we fail. But unless we're going to make that solid decision that I want to give him my all, then I'm afraid we will slip into the mistakes that I'm afraid are written all through the Bible, this mixture of flesh and spirit resulting in disaster.